The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Yes, it is time for the bookshelf here on The Hard Shoulder. Last week, the singer Brian Kennedy placed The Graces by Siobhan McGowan up there, pride of place now, on the Hard Shoulder bookshelf, teeming with books, but we haven't stopped. Mancon McGann is with me, the author and television presenter, documentary maker as well. Mancon, you're very, very welcome. How are you?
So good. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you. So was this a difficult task we set when we said to pick one book above all others to go up on a shelf?
Yeah, I mean, do you know the way I still regularly am in the Dublin Library getting new books out. So the amount of books I get through in a week, it is so hard. But there's a book, whenever someone asks me, just because it's a book that has made an impact for so long on me, from when I was a kid up until now. So I just love singing its praises.
And what is that?
It's The Brendan Voyage. The Brendan Voyage by Tim Severn. So Tim Severn, the sort of English adventurer who in his time like recreated a lot of old journeys. He had won the Sinbad Voyage. So some of these old mythical journeys are not here trying to recreate them. And in 1977, he gets this idea that he wants, actually he begins in May 76, ends in 77. He wants to recreate St. Brendan's Voyage. You know, so the 6th century account we have in Latin about St. Brendan the Navigator, this Kerry man who goes the whole way, possibly, you know, to the New World. And it was always thought it was myth, but Tim Severn decides he wants to recreate it. Now, I was, in 1976, I was 6 and I was on the pier when he was leaving. So that's another reason why.
Oh, wow, you remember it.
I do, yeah.
Was it a big event here at the time?
It was huge.
Okay.
Oh, like my granny, it was the most important thing. My granny was this Republican revolutionary, you know, and she thought that Tim Severn's act in 1977-6 was the next element. It was going to show that almost we had found America, you know. So every day, like RT News, people would just be obsessed with what was happening. And then the book came out and then the movie. And when the book came out, I was in Easton's, on O'Connell Street. With my granny gave me a day off school and brought me to see Tim Severn, and he signed the book. But he signed the book to me rather than my granny. It was the first time I saw jealousy on my granny's face. anyway, but I tell you. So he decides he needs to recreate this journey from the 6th century.
Hmm.
Which is so hard. All we have is we had a medieval painting, you know, from an old manuscript of a navogue or a curragh, the leather, or well, now canvas, but used to be leather clad, you know, light timber boat. So then he needs to find exactly how he can create one that would have potentially crossed the Atlantic all those years ago. So he goes and he finds, okay, who are the people? How were they making leather? You know, how were they making the rope? They weren't using nails. What were they using instead? What were they going to use to waterproof the whole thing? And luckily, because it was 1976, there were still craftspeople who just about knew how to work with old rope, with old leather, with the, you know, binding things that probably if you tried it now, they just wouldn't be there. You know, that was the 70s was almost the last sense of that old craft orientated way of being. So that was like the first few chapters are all about that. Just the doing his head in, talking to scientists, talking to folklorists, talking to experts. And then he has to gather his team together. And he realised, I'm going to be crossing the Atlantic on an open boat, something that people say can't be done, that this was just a myth. And so he gets one of them, actually, is called Arthur McGann, sort of not quite a relation. They're the rich, elite Protestant McGanns. We were probably the illegitimate McGanns who were, you know, some lusty lord had us and didn't really, we weren't fully legitimate. But this man, Boots McGann, was one. But the real sort of hero in the Olm was a man called Trundor. And Trundor was from the Faroes. So Trundor still knew the ways of living on the sea that like St. Brendan would have known in the 6th century.
Yeah.
So like he was able to catch a live fulmar, you know, a massive, like a gannet or a wild seabird, just by hooking it from the sky. He was able to kill whales use just from his light little leather, which is really just a canoe or a kayak, and he was able to like fish for cod in 300 feet of waters, in huge depths of waters. So he was the one who kept them alive. And they realized the way they were going to do it, I don't want to give too much away, I won't give any of their great adventures, but there was an old way that the Vikings used to do it. Like, you remember the Irish, what, 60% of Iceland is Irish. In fact, I have a new book coming out in June about Ireland and Iceland. But anyway, so the Vikings used to come up to Ireland by step by step. So first you go into the Hebrides, Then you went to the Faroes. Then you go to Iceland. Mm. And when he got that far, then he continued to along the sort of Labrador coast, which is Greenland, along the Labrador coast, and eventually to Newfoundland. But every day, I mean, the book is just so adventurous because you think they're no, there's no way they're going to succeed. They come across massive storms. They come with their tiny, gentle boat, like, is ripped asunder with icebergs. It's such an adventure story. And to think that these were... It was an Irish boat. It was an Irish story. Some of the crew were Irish. It's heroic in every way.
And does Tim Severin, does he just present the journey as it was, or does he offer his own musings or his own interpretations as to kind of what this meant?
Yeah, so he's like, you know, he's very, very British, very English, very sort of military, and he's very droll, basically about his own ACD, his own control freakery, and then the subtleties and interrelation dialogue of the group on the boat.
Yeah.
That's always really funny. They're all sort of tough men who aren't very good with their emotions. But when it's almost like a Shackleton expedition.
Yeah.
The journey, when they have to put on their submersibles and go down and fix a tear in the boat, you know, then that's when they show their real metal. But one thing I loved was so they brought modern equipment with them, okay? And they had a radio, UVF radio, and other things. And they realized that the modern equipment, their modern clothing, the modern technology, the food, it all worked until it collapsed. And whether it was the dehydrated food or whether it was the modern clothing it ripped or something, and then there was no way you could fix it. But once they were relying on just their woolen jumpers, which had so much of the sheep oil in them, or just, you know, using leather tongs instead of using modern equipment, yes, they could break, but you could fix them immediately. So it was like they were so much more resilient, so much more. They could not have done that journey had they relied on modern equipment in an old boat. You know,
they had
to go full on in the past. And like one of my favourite places in Ireland is the Museum of Country Life up in Mayo in Castlebar.
Yeah.
Because basically it shows how we lived in Ireland up until, the 1950s, before plastic buckets, before plastic rope. Everything was made from the site, and we thrived on that. And that was the same way that St. Brendan would have existed 600 years ago, and the same way the Neolithic people would have existed, like, whatever, four and a half.
It's funny, I was only having this conversation with someone very recently. They talked about their own grandmother who lived to the age of, 102 or 3.
Yeah.
And we said, what's amazing, the world she grew up in was not that remarkably different from the world that the previous 10 generations grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it would be unrecognizable to her today, the world we live in. It's amazing how quickly everything about life has changed.
We're so lucky, the likes of us in our generation, we just about remember. Like, I remember in 1970 seeing the milk carts go, just the horse and cart with one milk pail going across the beach to the creamery.
Yeah.
And the family, the farms would have had 5 cows. And yet we're also seeing the AI age. Like, it's really exciting. But I'd recommend not only read the book, but if you can watch the TV, find bits of the TV series or the film on YouTube. And even my first great journey in my life was across Africa at the age of 19 or 20 in 1989. And I brought the soundtrack of the Brendan Voyage with
me. I was wondering where you were going to say it, because I was going to say it. And the Brendan Voyage is a beautiful piece of music.
Yeah, exactly. That was Sean Davies composed it, and Liam O'Flynn on the Ellen Pipe. And God, That just gets my adrenaline going every time.
All right. Well, listen, that's a great choice. The Brendan Voyage by Tim Severin. We always had an honourable mention of a few other books, a couple of other books. What did you want to mention?
Just in case, if there's someone who hasn't read for a while and wants to get in, the one book I can guarantee that'll just absolutely obsess you and you'll get addicted and you'll get through it in no time, even if you think that normally it takes you 3 months to read a book, is The Sisters Brothers by Patrick DeWitt. The Sisters Brothers.
Mm.
So it's about two brothers called Charlie and Eli Sisters, which just, so it makes this great name.
Yeah.
And they're in Gold Rush era America. So 1850s, they're going from Oregon down to California, to San Francisco. And it's just the dynamic of two brothers. It's the one pragmatic, serious, sort of kind of violent brother, and then his idealistic dreamer, sort of dropout other brother. And they're being sent on this journey by the Commodore, this mysterious man who controls them and wants them to sort of, seems to want them to kill someone. But that's actually very vague in the background.
Yeah.
It's really just the dynamic of them. And the first time they meet a dentist who has a toothbrush and is trying to bring on the idea, it's like of brushing your teeth is going to be the savior. Just like all the sort of internet people now saying the one tip that's going to, you know, yeah, save your life. Dieting was the idea of a diet was just coming in. The idea of a toothbrush was just coming in. And it's just such hilarious. It's set in the Wild West, so it's kind of colorful. And the characters are amazing. I can't.
It's funny. It overlaps with the point we just made. You know, when people might ask you as a, in an interview or just around a dinner table, if you could live at any other time in history, when would you live? Yeah. And I always say I'd find it very hard to go back before the invention of toothpaste and the toothbrush. You know what I mean? You don't think of these things.
No,
until you sit on the medieval toilet and you're searching around for the Andrex and you realise it's not there. It's not there.
Exactly.
I actually read it a few years ago. I probably read it when it came out first.
Yeah.
And I don't remember much about it, except that not a lot happens in it, like, which is kind of the point. It's about that relationship.
It's very like
a
Coen Brothers movie.
That's a great way to describe it.
Quirky characters and quirky situations, and also there's this great Western book, True Grit, which is in the old style. It's sort of based on that. You know?
Yeah,
gnarly. You can imagine Nick Nolte or someone playing the role. In fact, was there a movie made of it? Of the sisters, brother.
There was, and it was John C. Reilly in it.
Okay.
I think may have been in it. I could be wrong. Someone will text in and correct me. Kevin Barry's most recent book is great. It's kind of similar. Time period, and apologies to him. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. What are you reading at the moment?
At the moment, I'm reading a book by Merlin Sheldrick. I'm rereading it. It came out a few years ago called Entangled Life. And Merlin, he is this, like, he at the time was his PhD student in his studies in just mycelium, the World Wide Web, how all of us are connected, how every crop, every tree, every plant is connected by these fungi. And the first time I read it, it's kind of dense, so it took me a while to go in. But he's taking part in a few different festivals this year, in Boris in June, and in the Gardens and Nature Festival in May, in Ballintorbert next month. And I decided, okay, I want to reread this because it excited me so much. But it just makes you realize that there's no edge to anything. You know the way they're now telling us that the microbiome and the bacteria within our stomach is bigger than us. So that takes up more weight than we do. So actually, it's all about those interconnections between the trees, between the plants, between our bodies and all those bacteria and sort of other enzymes that just, it blows me away.
One of the concepts, isn't it, of The Last of Us, if people are watching it on Sky, they're all connected, the so-called clickers to the fungus. That actually, over at The Hidden Life of Trees, I know you wanted to, because that doesn't overlap there.
Totally.
That's about that interconnectivity.
Exactly. And of course, Merlin talks about that. So that's Peter Velleben, this German man who was looking after a big beech forest in Germany. And he just begins to realize, wait there, that we always thought, and I have, you know, my forest down in Westmeath, and I'm always looking for these totally straight, perfect trees that'll be, you know, I don't know, valuable in 120 years' time. Where he's realizing, no, it's actually the interrelations of all the trees. And as you said, there was a woman in Canada in about 2009 who started tracing the mycelium and realizing that all those trees are talking to each other. And so the mama and papa trees are giving more of their food. In other words, they go to the roots, go out to the mycelia. The mycelia then take in carbon from another tree, because of course mycelia can't produce, they can't do photosynthesis, so they depend on the trees, and then in return the mycelium give other nutrients to the forest. But the main message in The Hidden Life of Trees that's so beautiful is that the trees aren't in competition with each other, not even with different species. They're all surviving and cooperating to make for the good of the woodland overall. It just upends our whole way of looking at the world, and it makes us think, wow, if nature is doing that, like, you know, maybe we should. It's this really humbling message.
I've never read that, but it came across a concept relatively recently in the last year, and I find myself, whenever I'm out in the woods anywhere, looking up to find a spot evidence of it, and it's crown shyness. This idea that, you know, that the trees won't for people at home, how would I describe it? That they won't necessarily kind of overlap up at the canopy. And you'll find these little, almost like, they look like rivers if you look up from underneath and the sun is behind it, with little tributaries going into it. It's actually amazing, that interrelationship. That's between two completely, well, on the face of it, two completely distinct organisms.
Yeah, so true. So you know the thing that got me, and it isn't in that book. So I have a drumlin, so it's a steep hill, okay? And so I have this oak forest going up the drumlin. Now, you'd think that the oaks on the top, they're obviously going to be higher than the oaks at the bottom, so they should get more sun, so they should thrive. But they don't. They stunt themselves so that everyone gets a bit of the sun. It's the most beautiful thing to see.
Yeah.
Like, so the ones at the bottom will go higher, and the ones at the top will go lower, so that everyone, it's like, that's how we're meant to work in this world. I don't want to get hippy-dippy or anything.
Well, in danger of that, we better wrap things up. The Hidden Life of Trees by Peter Woolhaven. Is it Woolhaven?
Woolhaven.
The Hidden Life of Trees. But the Brendan Voyage by Tim Severin is what is going up onto the Hard Shoulder bookshelf. Michael McGann. Michael, thanks a million. Carmela.
And look, they're all men. They're all men. And luckily last week, Brendan Kennedy had a woman. Good.
Well,
for
isn't it? Yes, exactly. Fair play to Brian.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.